Welcome to Notable Lectures. This is the third of six lectures on the philosophy of mind and body presented at the University of Adelaide by Professor Hilary Putnam. This lecture is titled Functionalism.
I realize that in preparation for the last three lectures, in which I will be very, very much concentrating centrally on the classical mind-body problem, the question would doubtless come up why I didn't consider my own former functionalist view as a resolution. So I want to tell you the story of functionalism and also why I think it didn't work, although I certainly think it was worth trying. And I also think it contains certain insights, which maybe I should say something about tonight as well. This all started almost accidentally. In 1960, Sidney Hook invited me to a conference on minds and machines, in which I produced a paper called Minds and Machines. It's the papers I'll be talking about tonight are all were all collected in 1975 in a volume of mine called Mind, Language, and Reality, volume 2 of my collected philosophical papers with Cambridge University Press. And I'll be talking really about three papers in that volume: Minds and Machines, The Mental Life of Some Machine, a paper called Robots, Machines or Artificially Created Life. It's been said that I'm the first defender of the civil rights of robots. And a third called The Nature of Mental States. When I was invited by Hook to talk this topic, I basically held a view similar to Jack Smart's, what's called identity theory. Namely, I was inclined to think that our psychological states, and by psychological states here, I don't mean anything fancy like the death instinct or superego or the states postulated by behavior scientists of positive and negative reinforcement. I mean what are sometimes called vernacular psychological states, like believing that there are a lot of churches in Vienna. The view that I was attracted to was that these are identical in 1960, was that these are identical with states of the brain or the brain and central nervous system. But I, in Minds and Machines, although that was the view I was most attracted to, I suggested but did not adopt a different view. That was the first proposal of this functionalist. Today it would have been perhaps better to call it a computationalist view, although I've learned that there was an earlier view in the philosophy of mind called functionalism due to John Dewey, which I probably still agree with, by the way, since Dewey is one of my heroes, as you know from the last lecture. That's maybe a reason to keep the word functionalism. Anyway, I should say, since I'm going to be mainly bashing functionalism, that there's a broad sense, a non-technical sense, in which I'm still a functionalist, even if I'm not one in the technical sense that I will go on to explain. I'm still a functionalism in the sense in which I think Aristotle was a functionalist, as I think of mental states, like thinking there are a lot of churches in Vienna, perceiving a bottle of water on the table, wanting some of that great Australian wine, being amused at the notion of an inappropriate relationship, I think of mental states as functions of an organism that are realized in and through matter. I will primarily be defending or elaborating that positive in these lectures, but this sort of Aristotelian hylomorphism still is the way I view things. And what I've given up, however, is a kind of functionalism that might better be called computationalism. That is the idea that these functions can be described using language from the field of logic in which I did a great deal of my work, namely the theory of computation and my logical work. Functionalism, in this narrower sense, was viewed us as automata. That is, my idea was that we're computers that happen to be made of flesh and blood. So according to this view, a robot with the same program as a human being would, ipso facto, be conscious. I guess I still believe that, actually. I mean, anyone who's seen Star Trek, any right-thinking person who's seen Star Trek ought to believe that. But moreover, the individual mental, but the key idea that I'll be repudiating was the idea that individual mental states can be identified with, are the states that would figure in an ideal description of our brains or of us in software terms, that these are to be described as our programs or as functions, mathematical functions of our programs. It may well be that the brain is a computer, or that it's useful to idealize it as a computer. I don't think that that's something that we're required to believe by modern science. I think that's still somewhat of an open question, but at the moment it's perhaps one of the most useful ways of thinking about the brain we have. But it doesn't follow from that. But I don't, but the description of the idea that my description as a person can be simply read off from the description of my brain is something that I will be calling into question in these last four lectures in a major way. I'll be not only criticizing identity theory, I'll be criticizing something that I took for granted and that almost all philosophers in the world, except hardcore dualists, took for granted for centuries, namely that it makes sense to talk of the brain state correlated with a given vernacular psychological state. I'll be arguing not that we have immaterial souls, that would be incompatible with my Aristotelian hylomorphism, but that this talk of correlation actually makes no sense. That this is a case where we've swallowed something as clear, which is anything but clear, but that's getting ahead of the story. Anyway, although in 1960 I only put forward as an interesting hypothesis the idea that our mental states are our computational states, I call them, in Minds and Machines, I call them our logical states. In a talk I gave to the American, in subsequent years, I'm getting ahead of the story, by the 1970s I had adopted that hypothesis and was arguing for it vigorously. But there was an in-between period which is worth talking about. I mentioned that I published a paper. It was given as a talk to the American Philosophical Association in 1964 called Robots, Machines or Artificially Created Life. Now, I think I made an interesting mistake in that paper, and discovering that it was a mistake set really the stage for what I'm going to talk about. Forgive this autobiographical style, but I find it often easiest when I want to talk about large parts of my work and not simply hone in on one argument to do things autobiographically. I considered the view that I just attributed to functionalism, the view that I said I still think is correct, namely that if you had a robot whose positronic brain, anybody read Isaac Asimov here, function in a way isomorphic to the way the human brain functions, or sufficiently close to isomorphic, then it too would be conscious. But in the 1964 paper, I drew back from that view. Instead, I argued at the end that the question whether any automaton, no matter how it behaved, was conscious was not really a question of fact, but I said it depends on a decision on our part, a decision to, and as I put it, quotes, to treat robots as fellow members of our linguistic community, unquotes. But when I came to write the other two papers, namely The Nature of Mental States and The Mental Life of Some Machines, these two papers I would describe as functionalist manifestos or computationalist manifestos. When I came to write those functionalist manifestos, I had changed my view. I decided that the question as to whether both questions, the question as to whether robots could be conscious and the question as to whether psychological states are really computational in nature, functional in that sense, to be factual questions. I had seen that the earlier talk contained an error. In the 1964 paper, I assumed that if an identity theory, a theory of the fact that psychological states are identical with brain states or with functional states, were true, then it would have to be true by virtue of two things. One, the meanings of the psychological words, and two, empirical facts that do not themselves beg the question as to whether a robot could be conscious. But by 1967, I've come to see that the same line of reasoning, if you applied it to the question whether light is electromagnetic radiation, or light or electromagnetic radiation of certain wavelengths, that you'd be forced to the conclusion that that too is not a question of fact, but called for a decision on our part. A decision to treat electromagnetic radiation as light. For, after all, persons who knowing what we do about the causes and effects of electromagnetic radiation, if there were any such persons who insisted that light is not identical with electromagnetic radiation, but only correlated with the presence of such radiation, they wouldn't be contradicting themselves. That light is electromagnetic radiation does not follow analytically, as philosophers say, that is, by the very meaning of the words, from so-called non-question-begging facts about electromagnetic radiation and about light. I now realize that it's wrong to insist that statements that make identifications as a matter of scientific theory, call them theoretical identifications, a phenomena that we originally described in different vocabularies have to follow analytically from, quotes, non-question-begging facts in order to be true. If we want to claim that light is electromagnetic radiation, we need only maintain that it's rational to believe that it is, given what we now know. The question of analyticity is a red herring. Thus, I was led to drop my concern with analyticity entirely and return to an earlier view of mine, namely that to return to the notion of theoretical identification and to a notion that I now introduce to go with the notion of theoretical identification, the notion of synthetic identity of properties. This is a little technical, but we need this in order because I will be dealing with modern materialist views of the mind-body relation, and these all need this sort of apparatus or related apparatus. I spoke of synthetic identity of properties because in the papers I published after the late 60s, I said that not only is light passing through an aperture the same event as electromagnetic radiation passing through the aperture, but that the property of being light is the very same property as the property of being electromagnetic radiation of such and such wavelengths. Okay. So there you have the schema. Here's light passing through an aperture A. So the first thing I say is there aren't two events there, the light passing through A and the electromagnetic radiation passing through A. They are one and the same event. The events are identical. Moreover, the property of being light, I say, is just the property of being electromagnetic radiation of certain wavelengths. So I insist to say that there's an event identity and a property identity, and that both identities are synthetic, that is contingent, empirical, not matters of conceptual analysis. In short, I held and still hold that properties can be contingently identical. And the way in which we establish that properties are contingently identical, synthetically identical, is by showing that identifying them simplifies our explanatory endeavors in certain familiar ways. Now, in my earliest paper on the issue of minds and machines, the theoretical identification that I predicted we might make in 200 years, I said, was an identification of human psychological states with the assumed corresponding brain state. At that point, I still thought it makes sense to speak of the brain state corresponding to a given psychological state. Also, I assumed in the paper that we might think of psychological states as more analogous to what I there called logical states of machines, states defined at the programming level, than to structural states of machines, states defined at the hardware level, thereby introducing functionalism as an option. As I said, I did not follow up the option at the time, but after 67, I took up the option with a vengeance and suggested that just as light, particularly in the paper called The Nature of Mental States, that just as light is empirically identical with electromagnetic radiation, so I proposed as a hypothesis, psychological states are empirically identical with functional states. Here is the hypothesis as I stated it in The Nature of Mental States. For the sake of simplicity, I stated it only for the case of pain, but I made clear that pain is only an example. Something like this was supposed to hold for psychological states in general. So, as we see, functionalism asserts that psychological properties, and states are just a kind of property, or strictly speaking, a relation between an object and a time, but psychological properties, states, are empirically identical with functional states, as with computational states. And as stated in The Nature of Mental States, using pain as an example, that means, and I'll have to show you the next transparency because I can only fit the beginning on here. One, all organisms capable of feeling pain are probabilistic automata. This is a kind of computer or model, abstract computer, and we'll say a little more later about exactly what that is. For those of you who know what a Turing machine is, this is not the way a probabilistic automata is defined, but something equivalent to the notion. You get something equivalent to the notion of a probabilistic automata if you take a Turing machine and instead of assuming that the tape is potentially infinite, that is, that more tape can be always be spliced on if it needs more memory, put a finite upper bound on the length of the tape.